Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Hellberg, and my co-host, thankfully, remains Vicki Nichols Goldstein.
Hello, everyone.
The Trump administration has fired 20% of the workforce at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and is now planning an 11% budget cut that may go even deeper. Today's guest is retired Captain Craig McLean, who spent a career at NOAA as a ship's master in its uniform corps, as a lawyer, administrator, acting chief scientist, during which time he stood up for science integrity in the Sharpiegate affair in Trump's first term that oddly reflected President Trump's inability to ever admit a mistake. Craig, before we get into your inside view of what NOAA does and is and why you think it's now under attack, let's start where we often do. When did you first connect with the ocean?
I'm told by my parents that I was on a boat when I was 2 weeks old, and my backyard was underwater at high tide. So I grew up on the Passaic River in New Jersey, and it was a very polluted river, which taught me some lessons that lasted throughout my lifetime and still motivate me today, which is that we all deserve clean water and a clean environment. I could not swim in that river, and it was one of the 10 most polluted rivers in the country. Yet right next to my home was a boatyard where I started to work when I was 14. I learned marine carpentry. I learned how to put caulking between the boards of an underwater hull section on wooden boats, and then later learned fiberglassing. So at 14, I got my first job. And I'm not sure we were too attentive to child labor laws there, because I was doing everything that the adult experienced journeymen were doing. But I learned a lot of skills there, and I learned a bit of responsibility. But more importantly, I earned the money to take scuba lessons. And I was very lucky to start diving with a group of fellows who accepted me not for my age, but for apparently my level of skill or proficiency. And we became good diving friends. They were about 10 years older than I was. Several of them were just back from Vietnam. They had a wild experience there. And I think the adrenaline of their life was sustained by some of the things that we were doing in diving. But I really grew to have an appreciation for the history of sunken ships and also the adventure of exploring them.
So how did you get to NOAA? Most people don't know that there are 8 uniformed federal corps, and NOAA has one of them. Did you go to a maritime academy, or how did you end up where you did?
Well, my first exposure to the NOAA Corps, David, was from my experience at Rutgers College, at Rutgers University. I had a marvelous professor in marine microbiology, and this wonderful lady's name was Dr. Carol Litchfield. And she had done some work along with a colleague of hers, and who I've come to know since, Dr. Rita Caldwell. And they were both esteemed marine microbiologists. So Dr. Litchfield had invited me on NOAA ships during my junior and my senior year to spend 2 weeks twice each year on cruises that were in the what was called the Marine Ecosystem Analysis Program. And it was basically the dump sites, the 12-mile dump site and the 106, the 106-mile dump site off of New Jersey. But the idea was to study these for what the microbial population was in these places where medical waste and anything else you could imagine had been deposited. So Dr. Litchfield was reviewing my applications for grad school. She looked at me very assuredly and focused, and she said, "I don't think you really know what you want to do specifically, but you want to do something with the oceans. Don't let your graduate school acceptance determine the direction of your career. Why don't you think about the NOAA Corps?" And being the wise lady that she was, with very good advice, I didn't heed it. I went and I worked as an industrial diver, commercial diver, for about a year. And while that was going on, her words were always in the back of my mind. When I was on those NOAA ships, I didn't know what those fellows were doing in those khaki uniforms up on the bridge. I was just concentrating on making sure that my test tubes were cleaned and the samples were appropriately applied, and I was doing the work that I was challenged to do. But then I started to work on NOAA ships as a marine mammal observer. And I luckily ran into two fellows. One fellow's name was Alan Bunn, and the other was Mike Henderson, but they each were recruiters. And I was lucky enough to be on NOAA ships back to back when I had these two recruiters. So Alan God bless him. He spent 2 weeks telling me why I would want to join the NOAA Corps. And then Mike came along and spent 2 weeks telling me why I wouldn't want to be in the NOAA Corps. And it was a nice yin and yang, if you will, because their approach was rationally different. Alan is encouraging me, and Mike was giving me the reality of what a service life is like and what you need to consider before you submit yourself. Today, NOAA trains at the Coast Guard Academy, and I think the quality of the trainees is exceptional. What are coming out of NOAA Corps today, I probably wouldn't have made it. I came in 1981, and today's NOAA Corps recruits are far more advanced in their skill set on arrival than what I had. But I'm very grateful for the career that I had, and it was very exciting.
How many hundreds of people are in the NOAA Corps, and what did you and do they do day to day?
So NOAA Corps labors at around 400 commissioned officers. The NOAA Corps officers actually are a personnel system in uniform, subject to military orders to go anywhere to do anything that they're deemed qualified for, from Antarctica to the Arctic, from the deepest parts of our oceans in the United States. I don't know that we've had a NOAA Corps officer get to the bottom of the Mariana Trench at this point, but we will eventually. But from the sky and satellites to the bottom of the ocean, and we have NOAA maritime surveyors, NOAA Corps officers that are working, running NOAA's ships, piloting NOAA's aircraft, and running NOAA programs based on that experience of the practical field knowledge and bringing that into various programs. But as a personnel system, there's 400 officers. Some pilot hurricane hunters. I piloted ships. I was in deep sea submersibles, a lot of diving, a number of things. I actually was in one of the hurricane hunters, but I just consider myself as functional protoplasm that was in the back of the plane while skillful people were doing their job, bringing us through a hurricane. But yeah, the work is very exciting. And through my career, I worked with some very interesting agencies in Washington. I was assigned to work with the Navy and with a SEAL team. I'm not a SEAL, but I was working with a SEAL team and we were doing exercises and basically field work. And then I also worked with the United States Secret Service when Vice President Dan Quayle and his family were headed underwater in National Marine Sanctuaries to go scuba diving. So I trained the Secret Service team to work on mixed gas so that they could stay a little longer than their protectee could. And I could go on diving the Titanic, flying through hurricanes. Oh, I've been a lucky guy.
So lots of neat experiences with the NOAA Corps.
And lots of public service. It's not only the National Weather Service and its satellites, but it's your ships exploring and defining our exclusive economic zone, which is larger than the United States landmass. And this wide range of services that are essential for the safety of mariners and ports and the projection of changes in weather. But I think it's really, and this may be why it's under attack, it's also been and developed as a world leader in climate science, identifying the risks of our, not only our changing weather patterns, but our climate and how that impacts our economy, our security.
If we look at NOAA and the mapping and all the data collection and analysis and the change that we're experiencing on our planet and the change that the ocean is experiencing with the carbon dioxide, how does that kind of fit into working with communities, societies, with public service, with assistance? And this is possibly what is annoying our current president, that climate association. So tell us some thoughts about that, Craig.
Well, I have two thoughts in that direction. The first one, I'll just start with, as we've been discussing public service. I was on a meeting yesterday. It was a virtual conference yesterday. And a very talented scientist from Shell Oil Company had shared the experience of early in his career working on platforms that were offshore in the Gulf and that they were putting in installations that would report weather and have that weather delivered to the National Weather Service. And he felt proud, as did his colleagues in Shell Oil, that they were contributing to the public safety and security because they had these meteorological stations on their industrial apparatus, the offshore platforms. And he felt a measure of pride and satisfaction in that work. And it just lifted me up to hear him say that, because that's what we do every day at NOAA. It's a gratification of knowing that whether it's for the marine sanctuary and the protection of the marine environment, educating the public of all ages about the importance of a healthy ocean that gives us half the oxygen that we breathe, the diversity of fish and creatures that are on the reefs and other components of the sanctuary system, they give us the quality of life that we have today. So that gratification of service for something larger than one's self is what public service is all about. And that's what makes it so frustrating to watch the Trump administration attacking everyone, whether you're in uniform or whether you're a civilian. If you're a public federal employee, you're presumed to be a bad person so far as the Trump administration is concerned. And I find that absolutely despicable from a person who had bone spurs, didn't serve, did so many things that were absolutely the antithesis of what we would look for as the model American citizen. But nonetheless, this fellow winds up in the White House twice. Okay. The position I had was the assistant administrator for research. The administrator is NOAA's code for the person who runs the agency, the person in charge. So we had Hurricane Dorian, which was a vicious storm that went through the Caribbean and took several lives in the Caribbean as it passed through. And multiple days out, the forecast was uncertain over 7 days out, whether it would cross the Florida Peninsula or whether it would go somewhere else. And as the storm got closer, the National Weather Service forecasters determined that the storm was going to make a hard right and miss the Florida Peninsula. Trump gave a weather forecast that said it's going to go through Florida and look out, Alabama, it's coming at you and please be careful. And unfortunately for the people in Alabama, there was uncertain concern because of the tweet that Trump had made. His forecast was wrong. The Weather Service had updated days before the uncertainty. There was never any certainty that it was going to go through there. So Trump puts out a tweet. The Weather Service, not knowing of his tweet, the forecasters who were known locally, were able to answer the question of the state emergency managers and local emergency managers and tell them, no, you're not under threat. The storm's going up the coast. You're okay. So when that came out, Trump was embarrassed. But David, as you say, the man knows no dignity in order to either leave something alone or admit a mistake, and scoring a hurricane chart and putting in an arc that never existed on the possible exposure of the hurricane. So that became a very widely celebrated press issue of the president's flawed weather forecast. But then the embarrassment that he endured caused him to tell his Secretary of Commerce, Chief of Staff, go fix this. So they wanted to figure out what, where, and who to fire, and how do we make this right. The politicals in the Commerce Department, and some complicity by NOAA-appointed people, issued a press release that was unsigned that said that the president was right and that the weather forecasters technically were wrong in their correcting his forecast. So here we had an incident of protecting the vanity of a president who was wrong, dabbling in business that he had no business to be in, and putting the safety of lives and property at risk because the trust that the public has in the words of the National Weather Service forecasters was forsaken in order to make this guy look correct, even though it was pretty widely known he wasn't. So when I saw that press release come out, I was livid. I was livid for a number of reasons. Morally, I was livid, but in terms of my work responsibilities as the assistant administrator for research and the acting chief scientist, that insulted the scientific integrity policy of NOAA. And I filed, along with other people, a member of Congress filed as well, and several other people filed the complaints. But as the acting chief scientist, that was in my domain to take action to safeguard and basically preserve the integrity of the scientific integrity policy. National Academy of Public Administration investigated the matter. They came to the conclusion that two people, both politically appointed, had violated the scientific integrity policy. And then what I did after that, once the National Academy study had been returned to NOAA with that notice, also an Inspector General report came to the same conclusions. I then sent a notice to all the political appointees at NOAA informing them that since they had been found to have violated this policy, they needed to send to me a written affirmation that they've read and understood the policy so that it would not be violated again. Within less than 24 hours, I got a message from the acting chief of staff, which is a politically appointed position, asking me by what authority was I sending out this request. And I explained this in three jobs that I have. One is acting chief scientist, assistant administrator for research. And the third is I'm a NOAA employee. And the policy lets any NOAA employee raise question as to the conduct of any other NOAA employee so as to preserve the integrity of our science and the way it's conducted. I got a very quick message back. Thank you very much. You're no longer the chief scientist, and thank you for your service in that role. So I was fired by the Trump administration in my chief scientist role for having stood up for the scientific integrity principles.
You were really a trendsetter. You got fired by Trump long before he tried to get rid of everybody at NOAA.
That was early on. It was early on. So the question is, for Neil Jacobs, the chap who was there at the time, what did you learn from that? And will this round be any different? Because anyone who takes that job, who has the integrity of the scientific position, is going to run afoul and run up against what Trump wants to be doing. And all we have to do is look at what's going on at, for example, the Defense Department. Every Defense Department for decades has been recognizing the concern of climate change. And looking at climate change components has been important for the logistical support of the services, but also the services in the intelligence community wisely look at NOAA's climate data in order to figure out where the pressure points and points of disruption will take place in the world. Where will conflicts arise in the future because of shortages of food, because of climate change and the like? It's rather embarrassing to say that we have national leaders who are turning their back on what the rest of the world knows and recognizes, and more than half of America knows and recognizes it.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
We're getting greater storms. We're getting all kinds of social impacts. And then to have NOAA disconnected from their data and the communities.
The climate information that NOAA is generating did not start out as a climate inquiry. Climate back in 1970 was defining the notion of at what altitude in the Andes might bananas grow. That was climate, basically. But what it became was when NOAA was founded, the question presented to NOAA, in addition to managing the Weather Service and running the National Marine Fisheries Service, was what is the relationship between the ocean and the atmosphere? One drives the other drives the one, and it makes weather. How? So we built ships, we built airplanes, we built buoy systems, we built models, we recruited scientists to come and work at the agency. And after a couple of decades, the answer to that question is what we know today as climate science. And having given birth to that new generation of scientists who originally started out as atmospheric chemists and ocean physicists and the like, they became climate scientists. But let me take you back to 1970 again. When the Clean Air and Clean Water Act were proposed, we heard the same arguments. Oh my goodness, if we do what these crazy green people want to do, it's going to destroy the economy and American leadership. Well, it didn't. And we cleaned the water, we cleaned the air, and the American economy led the world. And up until recently, we should be expected to continue to lead the world because of those technical proficiencies and the scientific excellence that comes out of American colleges, universities, private sector components, and also federal agencies like NOAA.
Well, how will the private sector possibly fill NOAA's shoes in weather data and prediction? Are there any thoughts around that? And is it even feasible, or is that just a crazy idea?
Well, at least with the brief pronunciations of the Heritage Foundation, which is very clearly the Trump playbook, as we have established, there is no definition or certainty of what that would look like. In privatizing the Weather Service, I would argue that the Weather Service is already enjoying privatization. There's a $10 billion industry that exists based on what you and your listeners and I have paid for in our taxes. And all that information is the backbone of what the Weather Channel, of what AccuWeather, and every handheld device on your cell phone bringing you the weather or weather radar is based on. That's all provided for free. And that whole collective industry is about $10 billion a year. There are people who work for commercial companies who are enrolled in serving under contract in NOAA's missions, in the satellite operations that we have, in the weather forecast chain that we have. And those people are already employed by commercial entities who then contract with NOAA to provide a supplemental component of our workforce. And they're very necessary and appropriate in order to conduct our mission. But we have not let the responsibility of that forecast go to private hands. It remains with the people who have been raised throughout their careers in the Weather Service in order to run those forecasts. So what's left to privatize is not clear to me, other than trying to run the whole show privately. And I'll go back in time. There was an effort by a commercial weather company that had some congressional support at the time in order to privatize the whole kit and caboodle. And that would be a disaster for a number of reasons.
It's a crazy moment. And what do you think, what's the response to this kind of craziness in trying to get rid of or gut NOAA?
Well, it's suicidal. It's like cutting your arm off in order to lose weight. And that's basically what we're talking about here. I think it's a clever statement to make. So our new Secretary of Commerce, Mr. Letnik, coming out of Cantor Fitzgerald, a finance house, I hope he realizes that some of the money that his clients made were based on NOAA information. The futures market is based on NOAA's information. I would have to sign a non-disclosure agreement when I would get in-briefed on the hurricane forecast for the coming season. People bet money on these weather-based outcomes, on these climatological outcomes. The farmers in the middle of the country, Iowa, Indiana, Kansas, they're learning what crops to plant based on information of seasonal forecasts that come from NOAA, not just from the Weather Service, but because we have buoys in the Indian Ocean to tell us what's coming in future seasons. This global world is what we need to monitor in order to understand all of this. So getting rid of NOAA destroys your futures market intelligence coming in. It challenges the reinsurance and insurance industry, the banking industry, the transportation industry, the food industry, the construction industry. It touches everyone. It touches even mom and dad deciding whether or not to put the child on the bus tomorrow because it's going to be an icy, slippery day, or do we have another means of getting the child to work? So the idea of cutting up the synergy that is NOAA today is absolutely stupid, in a word, and it signifies a hatred and a well-pronounced animus towards the federal workforce on the mistaken belief that if you just magically privatize this, number one, it's going to be cheaper, and number two, it's going to be better performed. Well, we've gone through many exercises to compare the cost of government versus the cost of private sector. I'll not disparage the private sector. As I said, we have many private sector contributors to our mission today at points that are economically salient and make sense to the American taxpayer. We have many, I haven't mentioned these, but we have many academics that are working in our mission today. 50% of the scientists that I worked with when I was running NOAA research are from universities. They are paid by universities, not paid by the federal government. And they work side by side, shoulder to shoulder with the federal scientists. So cutting NOAA apart is disassembling the economic engine of the United States in ways that most people don't see and don't realize. We have failed to show the people what we do and why it counts.
What does it look like for getting it back together? Say within a year or two, things change politically. Is it possible to regain what we are losing, or are we going to be so far behind that we won't ever be able to catch up?
I'm hopeful that a recovery would be made because we know the model. We built the model. The World Meteorological Organization looks to NOAA in the United States as to how to build a competent weather service. We've been the model for so many things. Weather Ready Nation, that came out of the National Weather Service. The radars that we're using and the switch now to phased array radar, that all of that's coming out of NOAA innovation, technological innovation that's from our research laboratories. But if it gets disassembled, we no longer have the input information with the same richness and reliability that we might normally have expected. So any delays or any reduction in staff and workforce in that area is going to have a consequence. So can it be put back once it's broken? What we lose and what we are losing right now with better than 10% personnel reduction just this far is that the ascension of the workforce to higher levels of responsibility with the mentorship of those who have preceded them, who can mentor and guide them. That starts getting lost as we lose people with early retirement offerings, the illegal firings. I'm very confident that those people are going to be returned to work because those firings were patently illegal. But still, there will be another attempt to reduce the numbers to get down to that same standing level of the workforce. But this is being done blind with a bathroom plunger instead of a micro spoon. It's a hammer instead of a scalpel. And we see ourselves losing people who have exceptional value to the earliest career people. And when we lose the earliest career people who have been very motivated and want to take these jobs in fisheries, in oceans, in space, in climate, and in weather, we then will have a recruitment gap that filters through the whole lineage for years to come. And that's a problem as well. So this is destructive, very destructive.
Craig, what can the public do? I know that we have had protests at NOAA buildings. I'm in Boulder. We've had thousands there just last week. What can we do to raise awareness and maybe halt this destruction of NOAA?
The congressional delegations need to wake the hell up. The types of town halls that you're seeing reported on the news where people are raising their voice and expressing their anger, we need more of that. The people need to be heard because right now, what people need to do is go to their elected representatives, raise your voice loudly, let people hear that we cannot tolerate this, whether it's for NOAA or any of the other components of the federal services that people are getting. And it's ludicrous. It's going to destroy the services people have become accustomed to. Now, let me take one big step back. Are there efficiencies in government that we can find? Yes, always. And periodically, one needs to take a look at these. The Clinton administration did it. The W. Bush administration, Bush Senior, keep going back. Everyone has taken a look at that. Regulatory reduction, we go through that. Unfortunately for the Trump camp, it doesn't go deep enough. And that's what they're agitated about now. But if you go deep with a meat cleaver, you're going to miss what really counts. You're going to be taking not those thin layers of what may be, I wouldn't even say fat, but those thin layers of lesser coordinated components, and you're going to start chopping out the things that we're looking at, like weather forecasts, climate forecasts and assessment, and talented people that we need.
Absolutely. Well, it was a delight talking with you, Craig McLean, former NOAA Chief Scientist, Administrator, and Champion of the Ocean. Thank you so much for your service and for being with us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.